and other abuses of power in America. Her weekly commentary on KLRB-FM is the most hard-hitting and comprehensive report of its kind in the country, relating as it does the news of the week to the evidence emerging about the conspiracy, which allegedly maintains its power by force over America's electoral and executive processes. Dialogue Conspiracy, a unique talk show. It's the most up-to-date, well-documented, no-nonsense political analysis going. And it goes over KLRB FM 102 on Monday afternoons at 5:15.
Well, good afternoon. This is Dialogue Conspiracy. I've been on this show quite a long time. This is number 129, and we've been going 2.5 years. This is a very, very sad time for me, because as of this broadcast today, I think I'm going to take a vacation from radio work, public appearances, research work. I'm going to drop out. I have to. The stakes are high. There came a point where I believe I was reaching too many people. I'm afraid for people that I care about. I have reason to believe that this is not a safe time to continue. I wouldn't be stopping it. I'm not afraid of my own life, but there's people around me. We've had accidents in my family, and the death of one daughter, and the other daughter was in the car. My son was given something by a particular agent on this peninsula who I've watched closely, some acid that affected his body and mine. For a while, he's had a hard time getting out of it. We've taken a lot. And it's not for myself. I would stop for my family, but there's a lot of other people involved. And I think the pressures at this point are going to come down worse. I have reason to believe that it's a good time to say that I've done 10 years work, and I'm going to sit back and let's see where you people or the Watergate prosecutors can go in the next year or so. It's a decision that I have to make. I feel particularly bad because I just received a letter from an inmate out at Soledad. I correspond with men, San Quentin and Folsom, and the prisoners, and many of them have copies of The Realist, the articles I've written, and the ones in the local area hear the show. And I've made a lot of friends there, I think, because I've told them sincerely what I thought was coming down or where the hurting was coming from, how the chain of command of conspiracies comes on these men. And I got a personal letter from them, one who's suffering from the lockup today. They got a notice that of the stabbings and the killings going on at the four California prisons, so they've ordered a lockdown of the four institutions. Since in the past 2 years, there's been 168 stabbings, 36 killings in 1973, and they're going to the four prisons, and they've come down. It's like a state of siege, a warfare stage. And this one prisoner wrote, said, for what reason is this being displayed out of proportion for the shape of the public? I don't know. Well, I know what reason they're doing it, and it's going to get worse. He knows it's going to get worse. And in this letter, he said, at this time I fear a lot worse conditions and a few more zombie warehouses in the making. That's what it looks like. And I wish I could say, yes, I can help you. I wish I could say there's a way out. I look at the condition. I was going to talk about the lockup at the prisons today before I got the letter. Somebody just delivered to me at the radio station before we went on the air. I was going to talk about the lockup because I was studying political conspiracies for 10 years. And when I was into my eighth year, and I was out at Salinas and watched the trial of Hugo Pinnell, accused of killing a guard at Soledad, and then got interested in the case of the San Quentin Six coming up, I realized and studied the conspiracies inside the prisons. They're nothing but racist places run by fascist guards like Nazi Germany, and there are experimentation places for future public who speak up, or particularly minorities, blacks, Chicanos, whites, white radicals. The prisons are nothing but farms to experiment and to practice pain on. The paroles are reduced. The men are trained for nothing when they get on the outside. They smuggle in drugs. They smuggle in weapons. I visited a pen pal in Ohio 2 weeks ago.
over Thanksgiving, and two guards were killed. So all the privileges were taken away. The classes were stopped. The prison was shut down. And he said, you know, a guard brought a gun into the prison, and then it's allowed to shoot other guards. And knives, 100 knives from a kitchen are missing. And they know it's going to happen. They give them the material, and then they crack down on them. And I wish I could put some continuity into what's happening in the prisons. All I can say is this, that there's a very important trial going to take place in the near future that I've talked about many, many times on Dialogue Conspiracy, and that's the trial of San Quentin 6. And this is the kind of trial where the California prison system would be on trial, but there's no more chance of trying them any more than there was trying Auschwitz at the time that Hitler was in power. George Jackson was singled out. He was a writer. He was kept in solitary confinement. He was exposing the system. He wouldn't bow down to their internal conspiracies that were going on in the prison. He was just one example. 2 days before the trial of George Jackson, he was murdered. The two men with him were acquitted. And then the trial of San Quentin 6 involves the phony escape plan of George Jackson and the massacre up at San Quentin that was synchronized to the Attica case. Now, Attica is going to have a trial for the men that none of the guards that killed the 43 people are tried. The guards are never brought into this. All the evidence and the phony weapon problem of George Jackson even having a weapon, or the discrepancies in his autopsies, and all the actual facts to solve these murders and conspiracies are as secret as the John Kennedy assassination or the Watergate secrets. You can't get to them. And then the poor prisoners are left with the rap. So the San Quentin 6 are having pretrial hearings. They're speeding it up now. They've been in jail, solitary confinement, 23 hours a day for 2 years. And now the jury will be selected soon in San Francisco. And what will a jury think for Attica or San Francisco if they have all this prison problems and all these killings and stabbings? And also, if any members of the San Quentin 6 or the witnesses know what really happened, the way George Jackson is killed, they'll be murdered. And if you have a rash of conspiracies inside a prison system where a whole group, 36 deaths 1 year, 21 deaths another year, 163 attacks, there's no way of saying, oh, they singled out Hugo Pinnell, or they singled out Fleeta Drum, or any of these. They have a whole series of murders before and murders after, but they've killed the people who know the way the conspiracies come down and who want to tell the people. So the problem in the prison systems is that unless people have some moral conscience about the California prisons, the prisons in our 50 states, and in the mental hospitals, what's happening in this country, we are directed towards a state of fascism like Nazi Germany. There's no way out. There's nothing provided on the streets for the people that are on the outside, so you know they're not going to let the prisoner out. And the prisoners, the way they control them and persecute them and don't train them and limit them. A man's wife came to see me the day she drove, got up at 4 in the morning and drove all the way up to see him, and the guards don't let him kiss his own wife. He can kiss his child, he can't kiss his wife. The stories of the prison tales are just disgusting, and they make me sick. My research was easy to do until a couple of years ago, until I really got into the prison system and how it related to the national conspiracy. And then it hurt me, because it would hurt me as much as if these were members of my own family, because I get hundreds of letters from prisoners, and I want to help them, and I want to tell the truth. But I'm reaching too many people now, and because I'm reaching too many, I fear for other people that I know, and that's why I have to go off the air now and stop all public appearances of any kind and just fold up camp for a while and let you figure a few things out for yourself. The Rosemary Wood, the secretary for Richard Nixon, has an article coming out this week about the Watergate. Her attorney says she's been made the goat of the Watergate tapes, and that she could blow the lid right off the White House. I'm so tired of people blowing lids off of White House. You know, Howard Hunt says I can tell all the seamy things I did for them. And James McCord said I could burn every tree in the forest. Everyone knows something back in that city and in every major city of the United States. And they are cowards. They have no care for life or truth of any kind. And all these murders and these persecutions and experimentations on prisoners and locking them up and taking away their privileges and their education and everything, and bringing in the National Guards is an irreverence for life right down the line. So Rosemary Woods now has said you wouldn't believe what they asked her to do. Well, I would believe what they asked her to do. And now her lawyer claims in an article in Newsweek that she's going down like a lamb to the slaughter. She can join Dita Beard. She can join Mrs. Hunt or Martha Mitchell or all the other people that know too much that are either in mental hospitals or they're murdered. But the point is, why did she work for Richard Nixon since 47? What did she do that she didn't think, if she knew too much, that she'd be slaughtered like everybody else? And she won't tell everything they asked her to do, because she'll get the Dita Beard treatment. She's either going to die or be farmed away. We'll never know all those truths, because everyone who knows gets murdered. Egil Crow, one of the plumbers group, came out this week, and he wants to plead guilty to a charge. And this is what he says. The sole basis for my defense was to have been that I acted in the interest of national security. However, I feel that the sincerity of my motivations can't justify what was done, and that I cannot in conscience assert national security was his defense. Egil Crow was the one who handled Hunt and Liddy and the plumbers that went into Dr. Ellsberg's psychiatrist file and did a lot more besides. Well, Egil Crow is going to tell you that it wasn't national security, but he's not going to tell you what happened. He's going to go to jail and plead a guilty and get off on a whole list of charges. They've already dropped his charges in Los Angeles for the robbery of the Dr. Fielding's offices. The Warren report was locked up on the basis of national security. Earl Warren, the Chief Justice, says there are things you will never know in your lifetime based on national security. It's the same garbage then. It's the same garbage now. The name of the game is murder. Copping out, Egil Crow isn't going to do much because the prosecutor is Leon Jaworski of the CIA and conduit, works with CIA conduit of funds and dirty tricks. So they make him look like a really good prosecutor. Like now he's got Dwight Chapin, like he's got Egil Crow. He's moving so fast. The image is, look, don't be suspicious of Jaworski from the Houston CIA Foundation, because look, he's already got two people talking. Sure, they're talking, but they're not going to tell you a fraction of what they know. And that's the tragic part about it. There's three movies coming here to the Monterey Carmel area. State of Siege opens December the 19th at the mouth of the valley. That is the story of the AID, the American International Development, under the guise of helping impoverished nations, how we helped to overthrow one country, put in a military dictatorship down in Latin America. The school to train the policemen that make bombs, homemade bombs, incendiary devices is in Los Fresnos, Texas. It's military-oriented. They teach death squads, assassination squads, such as in Brazil. And this is where you kill people like George Jackson. You don't have trials. There aren't going to be any more trials. I'm going that into a minute into killing Juan Corona, or trying to kill Corona, stabbing him, or DeSavo. Men that are innocent, they gang up and kill him because these men really can't have a trial. Who does those death squads in Brazil that eliminates having trials? Political prisoners are trained right in Texas. Jack Ruby was killed in jail. DeSavo was killed in jail. Corona was stabbed. These men are trained in Texas, and they work in the military regimes of Brazil, Guatemala, Thailand, Uruguay, Panama, El Salvador. As I've said many times, this country has financed and helped overthrow. It's about 90 military dictatorships. And I think that America, beginning with certainly with Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the bombs, there was a saying that we won the war, but we lost the peace. But I see nothing but tragedy and death around us, and I see a bunch of helpless people who can't raise their hand and write a letter or dial a phone and call a public official or radio talk show. There are a lot of people out there who care, but they're so scared. They're so scared. People are afraid to call my house. Is your line tapped? Or send a letter. They're afraid to put a return address. If everybody weren't scared and just worked together for 2.5 years, we would have maybe gotten a lot further. But I'm out here in the front speaking, and there's so many people out there scared. Executive Action is coming to the Village Theater. Christmas Day, it's supposed to come in Carmel. These things should be supported, these movies. The theater managers take a lot of flack. People who are sympathetic to these subjects, people who want to know what's going on in the world, should make a point of seeing these movies. If you saw Executive Action up in San Francisco or Los Angeles during vacation or San Jose, you should support your local theater and see it again anyway, because they have the courage to produce it. The movie The Second Gun was made It showed in Boston, and it showed in New York City, and I predicted that when that came to California, it would be the beginning of Watergate West. It's the shooting of Robert Kennedy at the time when he won his chances of winning the presidency in 68 were close. It was the night of his primary victory in California at the Ambassador Hotel, and there was a second gun there held by a man who works at Lockheed who shot Robert Kennedy 1 inch from the back of the head. And I thought that when the second gun came out, it took several years to produce. The producer, Mr. Emerson, was murdered. The wife of Godfrey Isaacs died in Carmel. She was murdered. He was the attorney for Sirhan Sirhan, or wanted to be, and for Thomas Noguchi, who helped with the autopsy and indicated the bullet wound was 1 inch from the back of the head. There are many people that died in connection with the second gun. And I thought when it came here, it would be Watergate West. And I got a call from Tom Graff, who has theaters here, the same theater that's going to be shown State of Siege. He called the distributors down in Los Angeles, the same distributors that were doing Executive Action, and they said that Warner Brothers has bought up the second gun and it won't be shown anywhere in the United States. So Watergate West is hardly going to move very far. No single copies will be available. I'm trying to get in touch with the people. I spoke to them yesterday to make contact to get a single copy out to be shown in Carmel for people from the Bay Area and from Salinas and the followers that listen to this show and from San Francisco area to come down. If they haven't bought every single copy yet, we're trying to get a single copy, and he's promised to show it and have a benefit showing, and maybe we can make another copy from that with the money. If we're lucky, we'll see the second gun. If time-wise we're not lucky, every copy's bought out. It's sealed, canned, and locked forever. After all that work and research, you're not going to see that. The last week I said on the radio program I'd talk about the second Oswald. There was a second Oswald in the conspiracy to kill John Kennedy. There was one at the car agency, at the rifle range, at Love Airfield, at one working with the CIA in New Orleans, a shoe salesman in New Orleans, in a barbershop in Irving, Texas, where Marina Oswald lived, and a furniture shop there in Dallas, Texas. There was a second Oswald, always using the name, who was a dead ringer for Oswald. And there was a picture of Oswald walking out of the theater with a certain shape ear, a little more pointed than the Oswald later that you see moving out from the jail the day he was shot. The head is a different shape, and one was shot and one is living. The burial was a mystery. We briefly talked about it last week before the show was over. At the first meeting of the Warren Commission, they had to decide what to do with that body because the nation couldn't stand another shock. And the police department and a newsman just came out with some little message last week in a paper commemorating the death of John Kennedy that a sack of potatoes was there, that a body was not at that burial place. I was going into the details of a particular person that I have had contact with and communication of various forms, who the minute I had a chance to meet him, I said, "You look like Oswald, exactly." And I was in a state of shock. But because of the situation that come down in the last week, circumstances that have made me reconsider how far I can talk, how much I can share to protect the lives of other people, I cannot go into the experiences I had with this person to protect him, particularly. There's people that I have to protect who believe in me, who are working for good causes, who will not exist. I fear a lot of things can come down and are coming down, and I cannot go anymore. I promised you the second Oswald, and I can't go into it. This show began just 2.5 years ago at the time of the Pentagon Papers in May of 71. And at that time, Daniel Ellsberg and Tony Russo stuck their neck out and took a charge of treason to tell the people of this country how the war escalated, how the war in Vietnam was controlled, and how the citizens at home were manipulated. I hope that people buy and support the authors like Lewis Tackwood, who wrote the Glass House Tapes, who stuck his neck out and it could be a walking target for the Los Angeles Police Department. Don Fried, who wrote Executive Action, and the two articles that I did in The Realist that Paul Krasner published. The Thunderbird Bookstore in Carmel carries them, and the Aries Bookstore in Santa Cruz, And again, the Pentagon Papers, people should own those. You should read them. Support these people. They're sticking their neck out. And I'll tell you something, they're not getting the kind of support from the people who say they care. I get hundreds of letters of people who say, I care. What can I do for you? And I say, well, buy the books of these authors. Support them. Get yourself informed. Then when you write a letter to a public official or talk to a radio show, you've got some information or facts. The Pentagon Papers, I tried to put it, it came out the same week, as I say, the first show I did, and I tried to put it into its historical context to say that it's only the beginning. The real story in America is the political assassinations and the continuous murders, particularly John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, but then all the other murders that have taken place since then. At the Pentagon was the beginning. Why? Because here was a boy, Ellsberg, fairly young, that worked at Rand, that worked with Kissinger, worked with McNamara. He was part of the inside team, and he had a conscience, and he spoke up, and he felt that genocide and killing the war was wrong. And it was the beginning, and Louis Tackett later said that he influenced, Ellsberg influenced him in his decision to disclose the San Diego plan for martial law. Then we had Frank Martinez, another person that worked down in L.A., and the Chicano group was a provocateur, and Larry Shears, who spoke up about the plans to kill Cesar Chavez and Eldridge Cleaver. But after these men appear and they put their neck out against the police departments, against the establishment, against the CIA and the intelligence agencies, the people don't support the documentation they've got. They don't write to Congress and say, right then, let these men examine their documentation. Tackett was asking in 71 that Congress should go into the secret police force that was inside the White House, that was an interagency illegal group that was going to overthrow America. Well, that's what the Plumbers Unit was. That's what the Watergate is all about. But nobody would listen to him. Nobody cared. Nobody supported him. He had a press conference that came and went, and that was over. So if I'm going to go out of my public life, if I'm going to stop this, you're going to read book reviews. You're going to see your local newspaper. A movie's coming. You don't have to have Mae Brussel say, go to that movie this week. And you don't have to tell me what bookstores to go to buy the books. The things are being exposed. You don't have to get books a man like Schlesinger can write or Mankiewicz can write about Kennedy or Richard Nixon. People that were part of the establishment that allowed these murders to take place, that allowed genocide to take place and mind experimentation, implantation now. People that have been a part of it all along, don't read their little smug books if they're lists of the bestsellers and they're just tongue-in-cheek giving you a little bit of information. Take the ones who stick their necks out, their life on the line, and tell it like it is, like George Jackson or Louis Tackett. Take the people that have been right inside of it, like The State of Siege. Go see those movies. Or people that have the nerve to make a movie of how John Kennedy was murdered, the Triangular Crossfire. Support them and get knowledgeable. Get knowledgeable. I met a young person today. I've known him a long time. Lives in the Carmel area, who always, he's known me, took me kind of tongue-in-cheek, and he's college-age now, and he was out at MPC College and saw the Zapruder film of the killing of Kennedy. For the first time in the years that he's known me, maybe all through his high school years, he was impressed by the movie and said, oh, it seems that in the 10 years the Warren Report was really a lot of garbage. And I said, that's right. You lived across near me as a neighbor, walking distance, you know, for about 5, 6 years, 7 years or more. You know, you could have come over any time and said, just show me the evidence, instead of saying, no, it isn't true. Just examine the evidence and then come to your conclusion it's true or it isn't true. But don't say it isn't true if you haven't examined the evidence. So in 71, Ellsberg came out, and he stuck his life on the line. He could have gone to prison. And in those 2.5 years, Dialogue Conspiracy, this show used to be called Dialogue Assassination. And the format was always to take the past or present murders and assassinations and show how they're linked together and how they're all part of a government conspiracy. We changed the title a year ago to Dialogue Conspiracy, but the name of the game is assassination because the main thing is that the power is moved by death. One way or other, you kill people to keep the power in control. Now, the Watergate affair broke June 17, 1972. And I felt that this was the most important event in American history since the invasion of Normandy, that the Nazification of America had been taken over since the National Security Council was formed in 1947. Totally illegal body, never meant to be in the Constitution, war-making policy, overthrows governments, decides on political assassinations. If anybody asked me to summarize my research of where the trouble and the heartaches began in this country, I'd say the importation of Reinhard Gehlen, chief of Hitler's intelligence, and then setting him up in Europe and formulating the United States government from what it was with all of its errors and flaws into a model of Nazi Germany, the way they put Hitler into power. And in the Watergate conspiracy, the men were caught. The total Nazification of America that would have taken place at the time of the nomination of Richard Nixon down in Miami or after his inauguration was forestalled by the arrest of a few of their agents, just a few. Up to that point, I maintained that the candidates for our free elections were eliminated either by bullets, like John Kennedy. If he won the election in 60, he had to be murdered. Robert Kennedy could win the election in 68. He had to be murdered. Mary Jo Kopechne was a patsy that was murdered in order to make sure that Ted Kennedy did not run in 72, and George Wallace attempted murder, which left him crippled. And this week, if you read your paper, there was an article, an unsolved murder in 1966 in Illinois, the daughter of Charles Percy. So going back to political murders, 1966 was an important year because in the 68 election was coming up, and it was a question, does a Southern strategy with Richard Nixon and then later following this same racist right-wing team like Connally and Ronald Reagan to follow up in their places, would Richard Nixon get in 68, or would we have a moderate for the candidate for the Republican Senator Charles Percy? So there was an interesting murder that took place in his home that was never solved. This took place in 66. It was never solved, but information came out this week. And what was the information? There was a group of men that broke into the home. Valerie Percy was stabbed. She was 21 years old, and she was stabbed 10 times, and the police failed to discover the murder. And just this week, the subject came out. There were three men involved of a gang, a Francis Homaner, Frederick Malko, and Harold Evans. And then there was another man involved, Leo Rogendorf, who was known from the crime syndicate figure. Well, the crime syndicate figures in all of these assassinations, the Vegas, the syndicate in New Orleans, from Vegas, from Dallas, Texas, Jack Ruby. The syndicate worked with intelligence agencies in Los Angeles, wherever a candidate needed to be wiped out. Officer Tippett in Dallas was a syndicate killing, a crossfire of two men. So there are some men in prison now. There was a gang of housebreakers. I mentioned the name, Francis Homaner, Frederick Malko, Harold Evans, and Leo Rungendorf. Now, Francis Homaner denied that he killed this Valerie Percy. And he blamed Frederick Malko. Now, Malko is dead. The man who's blamed for the murder is dead. Supposedly, he escaped from authorities and plunged in a river in 1967, and he's dead. He belonged to a particular gang. He laughed about the killing at the time. This is a man now in Illinois in the prison talking. He laughed about the killings and said he would never get caught. Two men were arrested in 1967 on other charges. They broke away, handcuffs and all. The police never got them, but this particular Malko was found underneath a river in Pennsylvania. The man who bragged about doing it but said he was protected and would never get caught. He said, I killed before and I'd kill again. Now, the story is that he went to the Percy house and the girl was there. She heard them and she was scared. And according to the men in prison now, the first thing she said is, don't kill my father. Now, here's the crime syndicate coming after Percy. And for some reason, she's saying, don't kill my father. Father, again, would be a contender against Richard Nixon in the primaries in 68. She started to rip off the face mask of this man. He stabbed her. And the case now is closed because they say there's no way to prosecute it. The key suspect is dead. In the book that I've talked about on these radio programs, Murderville, USA, maybe I'll have 30 witnesses to primary political murders that each have been murdered that would be the connecting link. So you have in this particular thing a man that could be a candidate against Richard Nixon in 68. You have the crime syndicate. You have him at one trial where he escapes and gets away. He has the assurance from the authorities that he's safe, and then he mysteriously dies, and there is no more to do about that. But the Charles Percy thing, maybe now, that was left open with a question mark, was indeed a political murder, which just got caught when he panicked, stabbed the girl, and didn't get upstairs because her stepmother came down with a flashlight. And they weren't prepared, evidently, like the Yablonsky family, to take the whole family. So he killed Valerie and left. Where are we now, and what is the summary of events now that I am stopping my 10 years' work? Richard Helms, the former head of the CIA, ever since the OSS days, is in Iran. He left behind memos contrary to open testimony in court that would be pure perjury, telling the FBI not to go into the Watergate investigations in the Texas money, the Mexican laundering money. That would open up Bernard Barker, who had money in his bank account in Miami and also at the Watergate Hotel, with the CIA connections and conduits of funds that are linked down to Mexico and Texas, and where the real assassination, the big one, took place, the John Kennedy, that would link it, Kennedy to Dallas. We have Richard Helms in Iran, and he leaves behind a trail of perjury and memos that he'll never have to account for. Leon Jaworski is a new prosecutor of the Watergate case. The Earth News, November 10th, had a bulletin that he may have cooperated with the funding of dirty tricks money in Latin America. Leon Jaworski worked with the Warren Commission. He sat in a room with Jack Ruby and Gerald Ford when Jack Ruby said, because of what I did, a whole new form of government will take over, and I want to tell you before I'm killed. And Leon Jaworski represented the state of Texas in that room, and Jack Ruby later was killed, and he never got to tell his story. He was killed in jail. Jaworski's on the board of directors and trustee of the Anderson Foundation in Houston, Texas, and a member of one of the largest law firms in the United States. I think they have 175 or 147 lawyers on the firm. He is supposed to investigate the Watergate and prosecute when he's been working with this team all these years. He'll do a little bit of hand-slapping. I read that he may not go into the ITT. I'm sure that the Mexican money laundering, that's over. Nothing came up at the hearings in the financial part about the money. They're ready to close shop, Sam Irvin and Baker. That will never really be told, even by Egil Crow. William Colby, the head of the CIA, was approved by the Senate 83-13. He headed the dreaded Phoenix operation, responsible for torture in Vietnam, for locking up 40,000 political opponents to Thu, for rigging elections from Vietnam. He's come home to America, so what can America expect? At the time of his hearing, Stuart Symington defended him. He said this was a man acting under orders. He accepted a tough job, and he did his best to carry it out, which included throwing men from airplanes while their friends witnessed it and getting the other guy to talk. Clarence Kelly, the head of the FBI, is sitting very quiet. He was approved by the Senate 96-0. Worked in Kansas City as a known racist. He came to the total perfection of the computerized, militarized police departments with their computer data and helicopters. There was a study that came out this week that the crime in America uses $4.5 billion to have patrols on the streets, and they've done a test case to show that it does not reduce crime at all. It just makes the police rich. It spreads terror in the black community and the minority communities, and does not solve the problem. The study showed that poverty is the cause of crime, and that these policemen, after spending $4.5 billion for patrol cars, doesn't begin to solve the problem of crime. We have William Saxby, who's been appointed, he's been nominated as the Attorney General. There's a constitutional problem people like Senator Byrd say is clearly unconstitutional to make him the Attorney General, the way the Constitution is written, so they're making a new law by a show of hands so that he can, he's not eligible the way the Constitution is written because he was at Congress at the time that their salaries went up, but that doesn't matter. They make a new law, make him eligible. He closed this Kent State investigation. He was personally close to the National Guard. He was involved with Governor James Hodes, and Kent State would open up what happened to the students, the killings on one campus, not all of them. Very controversial, clear-cut conspiracy. We're not going to hear about Kent State. He dropped a probe in his own state in 1967 involving police payoffs, politicians, gamblers. I wonder if there's any connection to his owning pinball machine companies in Illinois, which he had. And he stopped the probe of his own state, and he owns a home in Costa Rica, the island which is owned by Howard Hughes that keeps Mr. Vesco safely there, and Donald Nixon, or one of the Nixon brothers, I forget which one, working back and forth with that team. He drops the investigations, like the payoffs and the police corruption and gamblers in his own state, stops the Kent State investigation, travels back and forth to Costa Rica, has a home there. What can we expect from the Justice Department? It seems that the second team, of course, in a conspiratorial system like this, has their backups. Gerald Ford was confirmed by the Senate vote 92-3. I'm reading you these figures. Why shouldn't I take time off from my work? Is it depressing? You better believe it. With Jaworski, the prosecutor, Helms, he's not going to be tried for perjury. Colby, Senate passes him 83-13. Kelly, 96-0. Confirmation of Gerald Ford, 92-3. The Senate says, okay, let the House vote. Now, one person asked him about his work on the Warren Commission, what he did, and he was helped conceal the largest conspiracy that took place in the United States. I guess the Watergate is the second largest, but or maybe we'll outnumber it in terms of various component parts, but you can break them down identically, every section to the Kennedy killing to the Watergate conspiracy, which is the whole syndrome going on in Washington. In California, Evel Younger is running for the governor. He's been the attorney general. He was the attorney general of district attorney of in Los Angeles when Robert Kennedy was killed. All evidence of a conspiracy was thrown under the rug. So Evel Younger moved up in position to the attorney general, and now he wants to be governor of California. So you see the chain of command. Everyone that was involved in every major conspiracy is moving up the ladder very successfully to a more powerful position of control. Mr. Bugliosi was the man who prosecuted Charles Manson down in Los Angeles, and he's running for the Attorney General of California. And he's going up and down the state. His great feat was Charlie Manson. Well, I called, he was on Jim Dunbar's show today in San Francisco, and I called up there to talk to Bugliosi and just have a few words with him. And, of course, Jim cuts it short. You can't get to very much. But Bugliosi's claim to fame in the Manson case is an outright conspiracy with every angle of a military operation, a government conspiracy. So in the time allowed me, because Jim says right away, we just have a few minutes, May. And then they let Bugliosi go on and tell one lie after the other. So in a few minutes, I got to hear what he said, and I called in with one question, and then I got to talk to them. He did admit that Manson was a dynamic person that should not be dismissed, that he was bright. Bugliosi admitted there are missing links in this whole murder case that he can't completely explain about Manson's control over the phone, over the family. See, the missing links I can fill in, but they cut you off. They don't call you as a witness. They don't investigate the links. They just admit there's missing links because they know there are, like there's missing links in Dallas. And it isn't a question of they're not being solved. He just admitted they're missing links. He talked about Charles Watson, whose trial was separated from the Manson thing, and some woman called in about Watson. And he admitted that he was held in Texas. He's a Texas boy, a straight model student, you know, 2 years of college. And how Charles Watson was tried separately from Manson, and how Texas kept him there and wouldn't extradite him till Manson's trial was over, because the image you were supposed to get was the hippie, the wild-eyed hippie with the guitars, with the chicks, the LSD, the acid, the influence of the Beatles. Manson wasn't in any of the homes. Manson was created by the media. He was an ex-convict, let out. He even knew sign languages of the Masons to give the judge at the time of the trial. So, but you don't think you call it the Watson murders, see? So he admitted that all the killings were done by Charles Watson. And then he let out something. If you speak to these people for 10 minutes, you get information. On the program, Bugliosi was talking how Charlie Manson got himself a bus, black bus, because Dunbar said, well, weren't most of these people up from San Francisco area, these chicks he picked up? So that's when I picked up the phone and called the station, because the secret of who paid for the bus is one of the connecting clues to the Manson operation. So I called up and said, who in Sacramento bought the bus from him? Because Ed Sanders' book on Manson, the family, mentions that as winter oozed on, Charlie Manson picked up this bus and it was outfitted with stereo and food and girls. And they took a long trip down to the Southwest in Texas and Oklahoma, all through the Southwest for a long time. And they never stole anything and they had money. So who was providing it? And Bugliosi said on the radio, well, the money came from San Diego. Well, San Diego isn't cling in terms of conspiracies. Believe me, it's linked in, and the Richard Nixon's friends and the funding and the Sirhan case And Manson down there, he was in the cell with Alvin Creepy Karpus, the man that made J. Edgar Hoover a great criminal chaser. It was interesting that, to learn that the bus came from money in San Diego. That he never would admit, you know, which family or trace where that money came from. Those are the things they don't tell you. He admitted, Bugliosi, that I put my case together, he said, on circumstantial evidence. There was nothing else he could do except that Charlie did it on circumstantial evidence. And Dunbar said, did the people show any guilt about this, the girls involved? He says, not. They sat through the trial and thought the trial was a farce until they were all convicted of being guilty. And then the girls got very angry and said Charlie had nothing to do with it. He didn't kill any of the seven people. He had nothing to do with it. But the jury and Richard Nixon announced while the trial was going on that Manson did it. Life magazine told you Manson did it. Manson was created by the press. Bugliosi said the inmates that were in prison or knew Manson were shocked to learn that he could murder seven people. Well, he didn't murder them. He was docile and sweet and well-liked. He didn't like blacks, and he wanted to race more, but he didn't do this. And then Bugliosi goes in and gives a little bit more about the influence of the Beatles. The song Helter Skelter was written on the icebox. There's a La Bianca home, the reference of a song of Blackbird, Rise Up and Fly. They interpret it as being the black would rise up against a white man. So Rise was written in blood at the home of the La Biancas. Pig was written in blood at the home of Sharon Tate at La Bianca Residency, based on a song by the Beatles of Piggies. They took words that the Beatles wrote, and they perverted them into the blood of human beings. So you associate the Beatles and the hip music and the Love Children with the cold-blooded killing of seven people, two sitting in their home watching TV and five others just minding their own business and not doing anything. And then again, Bugliosi, who's running for the Attorney General of this state, is coming out with a book. He's writing with a man of the Bay Area. And it'll be the historical account, because he says the other book, The Family, wasn't no hard, cold facts. I have the facts. And with every conspiracy, with every murder, there's a CIA a writer that writes the official, like Robert Kaiser wrote RFK Must Die. You'll get the official story, well, Bugliosi's story on the Manson case. Manchester did the thing, the death of a president. None of these books are historically accurate, and they don't come up with documentary evidence, but they're sold by Random House, the big publishers, as a big budget, and people begin to believe all that coming down. So Gerald Ford, we've talked about Ford and Younger and Bugliosi. There are two things I want to talk about that took place this week that also make me sick. I'm going to miss these shows because I'm throwing out ideas I want to share with you, and I'm reaching people who can understand, I think, for the first time what's really coming down and what's happened to us. And I feel like I'm letting you down by not going on, but I have to go off the air, and I just have to. And so I'm going to. It's not that I want to. And the one is the attempted killing of Juan Corona. He's almost dead. They accused him of killing 25 farm workers. A new trial was coming up. He was popular in the jail. No motivation is what they say from out of the prison. He was going about his business, planning his appeal. He lost one eye. He was stabbed 32 times. This brings a lot of suspicion on migrant farm workers, on Chicanos, on mass murders. We needed a whole series of mass murders in California to create the total police state, and we built them up. And Juan Corona could prove his innocence. If he had another trial, he could have done it. This one woman held out and was forced and threatened, and the judge still didn't call it a mistrial. Albert DeSava was killed in Boston. Just like the DA running for an office in Los Angeles or anywhere else, a DA promised, if I'm elected, I will find the Boston Strangler who killed 11 nurses. And he brought in this Albert DeSava, who never had a trial. And wouldn't you know that F. Lee Bailey of the CIA was the man who made him plead guilty? And DeSava filed a lawsuit against F. Lee Bailey because Bailey used to refer to him as the Strangler. And the district attorney couldn't get they said, we can't have a trial on DeSava. And they never had one because he said we couldn't get a conviction. They couldn't find anything linking to the 11 nurses, and he said he didn't do it. And F. Lee Bailey, like the way they did with James Ray, who wants another trial, he didn't kill Martin Luther King, and he says he didn't. This man has claimed his innocence, and he was killed. And the death was described as he was executed, the paper said. He never had a chance. It was in a professional manner. His body wasn't discovered for 10 hours. No one is being charged with the killing. There's not enough evidence. Well, This is 1 minute up. I've been on for 2.5 years, and in the last minute, I want to say thank you to KLRB. They've been fantastic. This station hasn't monitored one question, one program. They haven't told me what to say. They haven't said what not to talk about. They've never censored anything. They've never scolded me for going too far. They've never been afraid of advertising. They've given me carte blanche to produce my research and evidence, and I love them. I just think they're marvelous. And I'm going to miss them. And I want to say thank you to Ed Johnson. All I've just been really far out people. There's no other station like this in America. And I really appreciate, and you people out there should appreciate them too. Okay, that's it for today.
And thank you, May.